This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Parker Palmer. He's the founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal and the author of many books, including Let Your Life Speak. I spoke with him in 2003. This interview was included in our program, The Soul in Depression. Download the MP3 of that produced show at speakingoffaith.org.
I called the Noonday Demon an Atlas of Depression. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's sort of a modern, overeducated city dweller, but you know, through his experience of severe depression, came tentatively, because he didn't want to misuse the word or overuse it, to talk about, you know, finding the acreage of his soul in that experience. And I'm also going to interview a Buddhist woman tomorrow about how she's worked through depression with, you know, with Buddhist practice. And I think I've told you before that I have also struggled with depression and had a pretty serious clinical depression a few years ago, and read your book. Did you publish your essay on depression in Weavings first?
That was the first iteration, yeah.
Yeah, I read it in Weavings and then again in Let Your Life Speak. And so what I'd like to do is just to talk that through with you, the soul in depression, how you've experienced that, what you mean when you talk about it. And you know, you've written so eloquently about it, and you know, I'd be interested if there's anything that isn't in the book that seems important to you now, or that, you know, if you've continued to reflect on this in different ways. But I'd like to begin just by asking you to tell me a bit of the story, you know, what happened, how you began down that path into what you call the dark woods, called clinical depression.
Right.
What happened to you back then? When was that?
Well, I went through two periods of clinical depression, and both of them when I was in my 40s. They were separated by a couple of years, and both lasted a year to a year and a half. And both were deeply devastating experiences. In the second half of each of those two depressions, I was constantly thinking about killing myself, waking up each morning wondering if this would be the day to do it, and actually practicing various methods of doing it from time to time. I never made any determined bid at taking my own life, but I certainly had it on my mind constantly during those times. I should add that during both of those periods, I needed for a while to be on antidepressants in order to sort of stabilize myself enough to be able to take next steps. But I understand the kind of depression I had as being much more situational than genetic or biochemical. And I always like to make that distinction, because some people have depressions that are, I think, 100% genetic or biochemical, and they need to be treated as such. Other people, I think, have depressions that are at the other end of the continuum, which are heavily situational, and they should be addressed in those terms. And then, of course, there's a tremendous amount of confusion between those two sort of pure types, where the two get mixed with each other. I mean, if you have a situational depression, you experience things like insomnia, which have biochemical effects, and so that side of the equation starts feeding in. And if you have a biochemical depression, you're going to get into situations in your life that exacerbate the problem. So it's an incredibly difficult thing to diagnose and discern.
I know you wrote that in your book also, that you felt that yours was essentially situational, but also it was really physically paralyzing and crippling by the sound of it. Makes this connection between body and soul apparent.
Yeah, very much
it?
So. I think anyone who's been there, you know, knows without doubt that there is a body-soul connection of a very powerful sort. Yes, it lays you low physically. There are simply days when you don't want to get up and are not at all sure that you can get up. And normal activities seem absolutely impossible. One of the things that I've always loved to do is read. And when you're depressed, you can't even do that. You suddenly become aware that an hour after you picked up a book, you're still staring at the same page. You've been paralyzed in terms of just taking a next step with your eyes or with your mind.
You know, for those of us who use our minds and pride ourselves on them, that's devastating for it just to stop working like that.
It is. It's an annihilating experience. When you're in the depths, it's an utter loss of identity. Everything that you have used to say to yourself, I'm a worthwhile person, I'm a person who's serving some purpose in the world, I'm someone who's doing some kind of work on behalf of some kind of goal, all of that gets taken away, and it is that experience of annihilation that I think in the spiritual traditions gets referred to as the dark night of the soul.
Yes.
The night of non-being.
And, you know, I know that you have worked through your depression and what it taught you spiritually, but you were a spiritual person before that and known to be a wise and spiritual, religious man. Did it surprise you for that reason that this was happening to you? Did it surprise others, or did you feel defensive about that?
Yeah, I think that the word I would use was not so much that it surprised me as that it shamed me. I already had an image. I mean, most of us do. Mine had partly to do with writing books about the spiritual life and with giving talks being the leader of a spiritual community. And of course, in my mind at that time, and I think in the popular mind generally, that kind of life, that sort of spiritual dedication and spiritual high-mindedness is not supposed to go hand in hand with something like clinical depression.
Mm-hmm.
You can put it more generally and say that in our culture, people who are perceived as doing worthwhile things or who are perceived as being successful aren't supposed to be depressed. And so when you find yourself depressed, I think one of your first thoughts is, I can't let anybody know about this because it's so shameful. It so profoundly contradicts the image that I've carefully built up over the years, that it has to be kept as a dark and dirty secret. Problem, of course, is that since you stop functioning, it's pretty hard to keep it a secret for very long. And deeper still, the problem is that keeping it a secret tends to make you more depressed.
Right. Or you end up exhausting yourself through the effort of that. I think that was my experience.
Yeah, you exhaust yourself, and in some way, of course, you are feeding into the annihilation of yourself by your refusal to embrace what is happening to you, by your refusal to make it, to take it in as a part of your life, and to share that part of your life with people who have some meaning for you.
Now, as you say, you had an image, you had a reputation, you were a spiritual leader of sorts, and the soul is something that you, it was part of your vocabulary, part of your working vocabulary, and that you were something of a teacher about. And I wonder, now, I know that in the very midst of a depression, how do you recall, could you think about the soul or what was happening to your soul in the midst of that? What would be your perception of what happens to your soul in the deepest, darkest place?
Well, it's such a complicated reality that it's a hard question to answer. On one level, you're not thinking about soul at all. Or let me put that a little differently. Going into my experience of depression, I thought of the spiritual life as sort of climbing a mountain until you got to this high, elevated point where you could touch the hand of God or you know, see a vision of wholeness and beauty. The spiritual life at that time had nothing to do, as far as I was concerned, with going into the valley of the shadow of death, even though that phrase is right there at the heart of my own spiritual tradition. That wasn't what it was about for me. So on one level, you think, this is the least spiritual thing I've ever done, and the soul is absent, God is absent, faith is absent, everything you've ever depended upon is gone. But on another level, in my case at least, as I worked my way painfully and just sloggingly day by day through this horrendous experience, I started to come to a new understanding of what the spiritual life was about, of where one found God, and of what the soul was like. One way that I would now put it is to say that all of the faculties that I depended on before I went into depression were now utterly useless. My intellect served no good purpose at all, and I have a fairly strong intellect, and it was just totally impotent. My feeling life was gone. People who've been depressed know that it's not like having a real bad feeling. It's like having no feeling at all, which is really scary.
Worse, yeah.
It's like being numb, emotionally numb. And my will, which has always been strong, I've always been able to exercise willpower to work my way through difficulties, that was shattered as well. And yet, as I worked my way through that darkness, I sometimes became aware that way back there in the woods somewhere was this sort of primitive piece of animal life. Some kind of existential reality, some kind of core of being, of my own being, I don't know, maybe of the life force generally, that was alive and that was somehow holding out the hope of life to me. And so I now see the soul as that wild creature way back there in the woods that knows how to survive in very hard places, knows how to survive in places where the intellect doesn't, where the feelings don't, and where the will cannot. Everything got revisioned for me, but that's of course, looking back.
Right. Now, you write and speak a lot now about the soul as a wild animal. Did that insight begin with your depression?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was this wildness that somehow helped me stay alive, catching an occasional glimpse of it, realizing that I was more than my intellect, my emotions, and my will, that I was some kind of, that within me was some kind of life force that was independent of all these things that I had come to depend on. And when those things were gone, that soul was still available.
And you also did the things that everyone, I think that most people who realize they're depressed do try to do, which is you did turn to medication for a while to stabilize, and also you sought a psychiatric help or a psychotherapist, but you had trouble. It seems like you wanted to find a great psychotherapist who also would allow the dimension of faith into the conversation. Is that right?
Yeah, it was critical to me, even though at the time I couldn't have put it in those words. Mm-hmm. But the story is that I sought out medical help and ended up seeing a couple of MD psychiatrists who were incredibly dismissive of any spiritual dimension to this at all, who simply didn't want to hear me sort of blather on about the dark night of the soul. They simply wanted to start putting me on antidepressants of various sorts and see which one would take care of it. And I found that profoundly offensive, and which I think was one of the early clues to me that perhaps my depression was not strictly biochemical, but needed to be dealt with in a more three-dimensional way. But it troubles me a great deal to think that most people who experience depression have access only to this narrow medical model that always involves administering some drug,
yeah,
and often does not involve listening to what the patient wants to say about his or her life. I just have a feeling that in this great complicated mix of depression, a lot of stuff is getting lost that might be very life-giving for people through this narrow medical model.
Right. If yes, and I mean, as someone who has also benefited from antidepressant medication, I mean, I know how wondrous those medications can be and how helpful, but it's really a very diminished and narrow approach to what a human being is, right? To just treat this with treat it with medication.
Well, that's my belief and my experience. And again, I don't want for a moment to say that people shouldn't be on medication. I don't believe that. I was on medication myself for periods of time, and it was helpful. And some people need to be on medication for the rest of their lives. Nobody should say anything that makes that shameful or more difficult to do than it inherently is. But by the same token, we shouldn't be talking about depression in a way that sort of invites people to ignore the reality of their own lives and the reality of the fullness of their selfhood.
Mm-hmm.
I see lots of young people. I do a lot of work in higher education, and I see lots of college-age students who are suffering from depression. And almost always, the quote solution they are given is antidepressants. Mm. They go to the college health service, and that is if they're lucky, and if what they've got isn't simply diagnosed as a study habits problem. Which it sometimes sadly is, but they go there and they get antidepressants. I talk to them, and in an hour or so, it becomes pretty clear to me that what they're really suffering from is the pressure that they've been under from their families, for example, for the last 10 years of their lives, to become something they don't want to become. The kid who wants to be an artist, who's been told from middle school on that he's got to be a doctor, he's depressed. It seems to me to be often a no-brainer as to why. But there's very little support to help people explore those life choices, those forces of distortion that often take us in a way that is upstream to the soul. That's against the grain of our own nature. And that's the piece that I think we need to lift up constantly in a culture that's always looking for quick fixes.
Now, when you finally found a was it a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist?
It was actually a Jungian psychologist.
A Jungian psychologist who you were comfortable with. He asked you, you wrote, to think of your depression as a friend. What did he mean by that, and what did that come to mean to you?
Well, this therapist, first of all, of course, listened to me, and he listened to me for a long time. I don't think that this comment that you refer to came until we'd been talking together pretty regularly for maybe 6 months. And the act of being listened to, of course, was inherently healing for me. I think it is for most people. It's pretty rare to really to be heard at a deep level. But he did eventually say, 6 months down the road, he said, "Parker, you seem to image your depression as the hand of an enemy trying to crush you. Could you instead image it as the hand of a friend trying to press you down to ground on which it's safe to stand?" And while I didn't instantly understand what he meant, and it took me time to really decipher the full meaning of that, the words themselves sort of jolted me, and certainly the whole notion that depression could be a friend was really quite shocking. The meaning that I came to make of it eventually, and that I believe to this day was right for me, is that my depression was, if you can image this, it was like a figure standing a block or two behind me, which from pretty early in my life was calling my name and wanting to say something to me. But I ignored it. I just kept walking down the street, not wanting to turn around and find out what this figure wanted or what this voice had to say. Well, if you image that literally, you can imagine that this figure, this person behind you, gets frustrated, comes closer, starts shouting and screaming rather than just calling, but you keep walking on, ignoring it altogether. And so closer still the figure comes, and now this figure is throwing pebbles at you and maybe getting close enough to hit you with a stick, but you, in full power of intellect, emotion, and will, keep walking forward with this great trajectory of your life. And so finally this figure says, "Look, if I can't get your attention any other way, I'm going to drop the nuclear bomb of depression right on your head." And that was what helped me understand that all in the world I ever needed to do was to turn around and say, "What do you want?" depression was for me the moment when I did turn around and say to this figure, which I would now call true self or soul or inner teacher, whatever you want to call it, "What do you want?" And when I started listening to the truth within me and hearing things about myself that needed attention in my life, changes that needed to be made, directions that needed to be taken, that was the turning towards starting to get well. So I did come to understand that the darkness can be befriending, that these great pitfalls that occur in our lives can have the function of taking us to a safer place. And one of the images I have is that for many years I was living at great elevation, whether you think of it in terms of the elevation of the ego or the elevation of the kind of spirituality that I was describing earlier, this sort of up, up, and away spirituality, or the elevation of trying to live by a certain abstract code of ethics which didn't have much to do with my genuine responses to situations. When you live at elevation and you tumble and fall, as we do every day, you have a long, long way to fall, and you may hurt yourself or kill yourself. But if depression presses you down to ground on which it's safe to stand, you can fall 10 or 12 times a day and just get up and take a next step. And that's an image that's come to mean a lot to me, that flows from what my therapist had to say.
So where is God in all of this?
Well, Tillich, you know, described God as the ground of being.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to think that maybe if I was standing on the ground, I was standing in God. I no longer think of God as up there somewhere. I think of God as down here, which I think is, in my own Christian tradition, is pretty consistent with incarnational theology, with the whole notion of embodiment and of a God who journeyed to earth to be among us compassionately, to suffer with us, to share the journey.
I love this. There's a sentence from your book. I had embraced a form of Christian faith devoted less to the experience of God than to abstractions about God, a fact that now baffles me. How did so many disembodied concepts emerge from a tradition whose central commitment is to the Word become flesh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a baffling question to me to this day, because I see it continuing to happen. But I take embodiment very seriously, and of course depression is a full-body experience and a full-body immersion.
Yes.
In the darkness. And it is an invitation, at least my kind of depression is an invitation, to take our embodied selves a lot more seriously than we tend to do when we're in the up, up, and away mode.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, though, when I think of depression, I go less to, I mean, I don't go to the dark night of the soul so much as straight to Jesus on the cross saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? I mean, mm-hmm. It is a feeling of total abandonment.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is a feeling of total abandonment. And I remember that in the middle of my depression, my friend Henry Nouwen sent me a simple postcard on which was a painting that had been made by John of the Cross of the crucifixion, apparently the only painting that John of the Cross ever produced.
And John of the Cross wrote The Dark Night of the Soul.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And if memory serves me right, this is his soul surviving, at least, painting. And I remember meditating on that image. It's a kind of abstract, almost modernist image of the crucifixion, and I remember meditating on it for a long, long time, because I did identify with it. And it was only after working my way through that sense of abandonment, that the bloodiness of the crucifixion, that I was able to come to these more what for me are life-giving images of standing on the ground.
So, you know, let's dwell with that for a moment, because I think one critique I've heard of how Christian tradition does not help people who are suffering from something like depression is that suffering itself, you know, by some interpretation, it would be said to be glorified, you know, in mm-hmm. Christian tradition, that it's good for you and you just need to bear with it and not complain. But you're sort of turning that image around in terms of the way you've come to apply it.
Yeah, I am. I mean, I think there's a lot, unfortunately, about suffering in Christian tradition that's hogwash, if I can use a technical theological term. It's awfully important to distinguish in life, I think, between true crosses and false crosses. And I know in my growing up as a Christian, I didn't get much help with that. A cross was a cross was a cross, and if you were suffering, it was supposed to be somehow good. But I think that there are false forms of suffering that get imposed upon us, sometimes from without, from injustice and external cruelty, and sometimes from within, by ego distortion and other dynamics of the inner shadow, that really need to be resisted. I do not believe that the God who gave me life wants me to live a living death. I believe that the God who gave me life wants me to live life fully and well. Now, is that going to take me to places where I suffer because I am standing for something, or I am committed to something, or I am passionate about something that gets resisted and rejected by the society? Absolutely. But anyone who's ever suffered that way knows that it's a life-giving way to suffer. That if it's your truth, if it's your identity and integrity, you can't not do it. And that knowledge carries you through. But there's another kind of suffering that is simply and purely death. It's death in life. And that is a darkness to be worked through to find the life on the other side.
And I don't know what's... I'm just struggling with this a little bit because, you know, things... There is suffering as in physical suffering, as in, I don't know, cancer or some kind of physical illness that can't be grappled with. Now, the thing about depression is not always, but often it can be sort of wrestled with and moved beyond, transcended.
Well, I've known people who... I know people this very day who are living with cancer, who have used that experience in an utterly transcendent way, who not about whom it isn't just me speaking, but who would say for themselves, this threat to my life, this disease that will almost certainly take my life, has made me value life all the more, and has made me more of a life giver to those who are around me. So I'm not talking about a magic act where you wave a wand of positive attitude and the disease goes away, but I'm talking about a way of transforming that darkness into remarkable forms of light that I've seen with my own eyes. I don't demand or ask of everyone that they do that, and how some people are able to do it while other people are not is a total mystery to me.
Right.
And it's a mystery.
You've also spoken about that mystery in depression.
It's a mystery I think we have to hold with deep respect. As I say in Let Your Life Speak, in the chapter on depression, people walk around saying, I don't understand why so-and-so committed suicide. Well, I understand perfectly why people take their lives. They need the rest. Depression is absolutely exhausting. It's why day by day for months at a time I wanted to take my life. What I don't understand is why some people come through on the other side and reclaim life with new vividness and with new intensity. That is the real mystery to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I only know one thing to do in the face of mystery, and that's to stand there with deep respect and silence and reflectiveness and simply try to learn what one can.
And the soul is in that mystery, I guess, for you.
Yeah, the soul is in the mystery. God is in the mystery. Selfhood is in the mystery. Absolutely, it's all right there, and it's a force field that we need to learn to enter to see what it might have to teach us. That we live in a culture that doesn't like the force field created by mystery. We like the force field created by problems we can solve. Problems for which there's some sort of technical fix. Give us one of those and we'll chew on it until we get the right answer. But give us something that that is, in essence, mysterious. And we really shy away from it because we instinctively know that we're not going to be able to fix this sucker up or even figure it out. But I think there's a way of entering into that force field that the spiritual traditions call us to, but that we're also called to by great literature, by poetry, by the liberal arts tradition, by all kinds of stuff at the humanistic roots of our culture.
I wonder if there's anything in particular in Quaker tradition, your tradition, that you think was especially helpful for you in processing this experience of depression sort of theologically.
Well, I think that one of the things that was helpful to me, and I should note that I encountered Quakerism in my life at age 35, not too many years before I entered my first experience of depression in my early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, one of the things worth noting is that Quakers, in my judgment at least, know how to respect the mystery. They know how to sit in silence in front of the great mystery. They know that silence can speak louder than words. They don't have a great need to conceptualize everything theologically or philosophically. They're, I think, you know, more interested in embodiment than in doctrine.
Mm.
And all of those things were, I think, great resources for me as I entered upon this journey. I think at the same time, it could paradoxically be said that it was being introduced to Quakerism and the sort of nakedness of the spiritual journey as Quakerism understands it, this waiting in silence, that may have helped take me into depression in part, because the silence, I think, forced me to start confronting things or understanding things or experiencing things about myself that I really didn't want to deal with, and that some other forms of religious faith, which are more boxed and tied, had maybe helped me avoid.
Yeah.
There are forms of religion that give you the answers, and if the answers work for you, then you're not going to get into this kind of trouble, perhaps. Although my own sense is that life comes along and disproves most of those answers at some point, and then people have to wrestle for themselves. But I think you could make a case that, as a friend of mine once did, I mean, I actually went to a friend at one point. She happens to be a member of a religious community, a sister, a Roman Catholic sister, and I said, you know, I've been on this wonderful Quaker journey, and I've been sitting in silence, and I've learned to pray, and I have been feeling so much closer to God than I ever did when I was just clinging to doctrine. Why am I now feeling so full of death? And she said, well, I think the answer is simple. The closer you get to the light, the closer you also get to the darkness. And it was another one of those phrases, like the one that my therapist gave me, that I didn't understand right away, but right away I knew there was some kind of truth in it that I needed to try to understand.
Well, how do you understand that phrase now?
Well, I can give you, you know, the image that comes quickly to mind is a literal physical image. If you're moving closer and closer to a very bright source of light, you're casting a longer and longer shadow as you move in. So on that level, it makes literal sense to me. But I also understand in a way that I didn't in early on in my journey of faith, that this God that we speak about is, in fact, as it says in the Hebrew Bible, a God who makes weal and creates woe, a God who is at the pivot point of everything, and whom we reduce to a kind of happy, favor-giving, domesticated God only at our great peril, the peril of not understanding what the force field of life is really about. So I understand that to move close to God is to move close to everything that human beings have ever experienced. And that, of course, includes a lot of suffering, mm-hmm. as well as a lot of joy.
And do you think that as you move closer to that, you're also given or developing the capacity to bear all of that, to sort of live with that tension?
Well, I think that's an ongoing journey. Mm-hmm. One image that's very powerful for me is that life, as I embrace it more deeply, will break my heart. But I have a chance I have a decision to make about how I will understand the heartbreaking aspect of life. I can choose, on the one hand, to think of the broken heart as a heart that's lying shattered in pieces all over the floor, a heart that doesn't work anymore, a heart that's died. But I could choose also to think of this broken heart as a heart broken open to greater capacity to hold the whole range of human experience. And it's that latter understanding that makes the most experiential sense for me, mm-hmm. and that's most hopeful for me. It seems to me that my own experience of depression has, in fact, made my heart larger. But I also know that day by day I have choices to make about whether to protect my heart against more heartbreaking experience, or whether to open it and take the risk once again that it will be stretched into something larger. So I guess what I'm saying is that there is a piece of this that's up to us, that depends on the intentionality with which we take this journey, the resources we seek on the way, the kind of guidance and community that we reach out for. But if one is fortunate in all of that, I think it's possible, yes, to grow a larger heart that is able to hold what life gives it.
I think this is wonderful. I think we're coming close to the end. I sort of want to just say something to you about reading your writing about depression. For me, when I first read that Weavings article, now when would that have been? Maybe 4 or 5 years ago?
Let's see. I actually have a note to it early in
the first time that you published what later was this chapter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see. That would have been, I'll find it here. It's in the footnotes.
I have the book,
It's somewhere in the book, yeah.
Yeah, all right. But anyway.
It's five, six years ago.
I think it was pretty close to my own big depression, or I may have still been coming out of it. And it was hard for, I wanted to read it. mm-hmm. It was hard for me to take it in, or even in some ways to take it seriously, because I was still too close to that nothingness. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if this is part of the mystery that time is involved. When I read when your book was then published just last year, then it was a great gift to me, this mm-hmm. image of seeing your depression as a friend. But I had to have some distance from that experience myself. Well, and then it was just, but it also says something about how this experience stays with you and marks you and is a part of who you are. I mean,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So I absolutely. Read your book, you know, really not in depression anymore. And yet it was a piece of my experience and it was something that I could work with in mm-hmm. a very present way.
Yeah. Oh, I think there's a lot of truth in what you just said for me, certainly, as well as for you. I just found it, the essay was published in Weavings in 1998, and
yeah.
that speaks to time itself. In 1998, I was 59 years old. I was almost 60. These depressions were in my 40s. It took me ballpark 15 years, 10 to 15 years, to come to the point where I could write about them. That's about the passage of time. I could no more have written about them in the early years of my emergence than I could have flown to the moon. It was just too raw. It was too intimate. It was too baffling. And it took me time to sort it out, to embrace it as part of who I am in public as well as private. So certainly the passage of time is absolutely critical. What I have found, of course, having written about it, is, first of all, how the very act of going public about depression helps me stay healthy. Because a lot of my depression was about trying to hide out the pieces of me that I didn't want others to see until they sort of made their own claim on my life. You know, if you won't pay attention to me when I call gently, I'll drop a bomb on your head.
That's a tough love friend, though.
Yeah, it is a tough. It is a tough love friend, and it's called true self, and you don't want to mess with it, you know.
Right.
Writing about it helps me stay healthy, but it also, I think, gets responses. It helps create community around something that makes all of us feel very isolated. And there's some sort of healing in the community itself. The number of young people who have said to me, thank you so much, as someone who has gone somewhere in the world, for talking about the fact that you went through this deep darkness, because I thought I was all alone in that. I thought I was doomed or destined to be a total loser because of it, and to realize that it's a shared journey with people who are farther down the road has been a great support and blessing to me. Well, that's a support and blessing to me as well. Anytime we can create community around something that in the culture tends to isolate us is, I think, very, very important. Worth doing.
Yeah, and you know, and again, just getting back to the subject of this show, the fact that I think the thing in the midst of a depression that feels so absent, I would say, is your very soul, right? The ground of your being has dropped out. I mean, I don't even think I could think about God one way or the other. I had to put the idea of God to one side.
Right.
And yet some of the most profound observations that you're making and that you're saying that can be possible out of some depression are precisely about those aspects of human experience. And
right. And, you know, as I said earlier, it as best I can reconstruct it, and a lot of it's hard to reconstruct because you're not, you know, you're so out of it that I don't entirely trust my capacity to reconstruct it. But as best I can reconstruct it, like you, the thought of God, all of those theological convictions were just dead and gone during that time. But from time to time, back in the woods, that primitive wildness was there. And if that's all God is, I'll settle for it. I'll settle for it easily and thankfully.
Okay. Well, let me just...
Krista, I'm going to just say one more thing about this, which is that the one piece that we haven't touched on that, and I don't mean to open up a whole new line of inquiry here, but mentioning community a moment ago and how important community is around the experience of depression also made me think that we haven't said much about what I try to do in that chapter in terms of how other people responded
to
me.
Yes.
And I know that in churches and religious communities generally, these are places also where depression is either taboo or it gets responded to in ways that aren't at all helpful. So for whatever it's worth, let me just at least name that that's a piece of the puzzle.
And I thought, and I also, when you were talking about how Quaker tradition, that people know how to be silent, I was recalling that passage in what you've written about your depression, about the friend who helped you the most, who would just come be with you.
Right. Yeah. This I'll just tell that story quickly because it's such a great image for me. I had folks coming to me, of course, who wanted to be helpful, and sadly, many of them weren't. These were the people who would say, gosh, Parker, why are you sitting in here being depressed? It's a beautiful day outside. Go, you know, feel the sunshine and smell the flowers. And that, of course, leaves a depressed person even more depressed because while you know intellectually that it's sunny out and that the flowers are lovely and fragrant, you can't really feel any of that in your body, which is dead in a sensory way. And so you're left more depressed by this, quote, good advice to get out and enjoy the day. And then other people would come and say something along the lines of, gosh, Parker, why are you depressed? You're such a good person. You've helped so many people.
Mm-hmm. You're so successful
and you've written so well. And that would leave me feeling more depressed because I would feel I've just defrauded another person who, if they really knew what a schmuck I was, would cast me into the darkness where I already am. Mm. They too have settled for my public image rather than being willing to embrace my personal reality, which at that time felt pretty shabby. There was this one friend who came to me after asking permission to do so every afternoon about 4 o'clock, sat me down in a chair in the living room, took off my shoes and socks and massaged my feet. He hardly ever said anything. He was a Quaker elder. And yet, out of his intuitive sense, from time to time would say a very brief word, like, I can feel your struggle today, or farther down the road, I feel that you're a little stronger at this moment, and I'm glad for that. But beyond that, he would say hardly anything. He would give no advice. He would simply report from time to time what he was sort of intuiting about my condition. Somehow he found the one place in my body, namely the soles of my feet, where I could experience some sort of connection to another human being. Mm. And the act of massaging, just, you know, in a way that I really don't have words for, kept me connected with the human race. What he mainly did for me, of course, was to be willing to be present to me in my suffering without either trying to invade it, to rush in with all kinds of fixes, like it's such a nice day, or evade it, kind of looking at me, getting scared, and walking away. He just hung in with me in this very quiet, very simple, very tactile way, and I've never really been able to find the words to fully express my gratitude for that, but I know it made a huge difference, and it became for me a metaphor of the kind of community we need to extend to people who are suffering in this way, which is a community that is neither invasive of the mystery nor evasive of the suffering, but is willing to hold people in a space, a sacred space of relationship where somehow this person who is on the dark side of the moon can get a little confidence that they can come round to the other side.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. This has been great for me.
Well, thank you for doing this important program, Krista, as always.
Well, I have to say, I'm excited about this program, I think, because I know how many people out there struggle with this. And I agree with you that taking this, you know, medical approach strictly is so reckless and it frightens me. So,
yeah, it really does.
Oh, really?
And yet the taboo is still out there if you talk about it in terms other than medication. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Thomas Eagleton was taken off the...
I'm old enough, yeah.
Yeah, see, there you go. We're taken off the presidential ticket with, what was it, George McGovern, I think. Because it was learned in mid-campaign that he had suffered from depression, and so he was no longer...
Oh, my gosh.
And I think he'd been in a mental hospital, I'm not sure, maybe had shock therapy or just,
yeah.
I don't know what
Thanks
it was.
Thanks for reminding me of that. Because,
he had suffered from depression,
yeah.
And so he was deemed ineligible to mm-hmm. serve as vice president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And my own take on that is that that's a great blessing, and it may make depression worth the trouble if it renders you ineligible to be vice president of the United States.
And now we have someone who's vice president who's had 3 heart attacks, and you ask yourself, what does this man value about his life?
I know, and he's got all the rest of us depressed.
That's
so
right.
It kind of whatever goes around comes around.
We can do this on public radio. We're on the same wavelength.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks,
it's just great to talk to you again. Thank
Take
you.
Take good care.
Bye.
Bye.